problem was they didn't pay anyone. They didn't pay staff, they didn't pay players.
The pros obviously sitting there like, well, we've got mortgages and bills to pay.
That was it. We were buying stuff for match days out of our own pockets, really.
Then wanting to sort of take equipment out of the gym, or, you know, take an ultrasound machine as collateral.
You know, I'll never forget when the supporters rallied around, and actually there was donations came in. Just the general public knew the situation and felt so strongly about what this guy was doing that they needed to help us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of The Circus Upstairs.
I'm James Masters, a slightly happier Leighton Orient supporter and journalist.
For listeners, we just beat bottom of the table Cheltenham, who only had 10 men for the majority of the game, and it took till the last couple of minutes for us to actually win that.
Fantastic. Delighted. Going to win the league.
I'm Matt Simpson, president of the Carl Fletcher Appreciation Society, so to speak.
Do you think people remember Carl Fletcher in the future?
Like I said, a stitch in time saves nine.
If Carl Fletcher was a Piketty appointment, do you think that people would give him less stick?
If I knew the answer to that, I'd be a millionaire. Lots of in-jokes for the Orient fans.
Lots of editing already. Lots of editing.
Right. We are in dark times at Orient. Can you remind us where we got up to at the end of episode 11?
Yes, Matt. So, manager number 10 in Piketty's reign, Danny Webb, is being forced to play a lot of youth team players as the senior pros are either sold or sent out on loan. The O's dropped to bottom of the table, 7 points adrift by the end of March, and Danny Webb says, I've had enough, resigning with 2 wins in 12 games. Off the pitch, our friend and CEO, Alessandro Anglieri, releases an absolutely bonkers statement confirming that Piketty is open to offers for the club and that the reason for Orient's poor form is that the players are missing Mr. Piketty's charisma at the training ground. Also turns out that Piketty hasn't paid the club's taxes, so Orient faced a winding up order in court that could have put them out of existence. The judge allows a stay of execution when Piketty's lawyer says he'll pay what's owed and is given until the 12th of June to do so.
Well, things are taking a turn for the worse then. So that leaves another vacancy. So manager number 10 has gone. I mean, the challenge of finding another manager at that point to take on that job must have been absolutely incredible. Again, I suspect Piketty just like hunted around the building and saw anyone who was standing around. Who did he end up appointing?
Well, huge surprise here, Matt. Huge surprise, because it was Danny Webb's assistant. It was Omer Rizza, who was the lucky man to be given the job. The 11th manager of Mr. Piketty's reign.
And what do you know about Omer Rizza?
Initially, not loads. I know that he, at the time, I knew that he was working. He'd been working with the youth setup at Orient. He was quite well respected there. People liked him, especially the young players. As a player, he'd had a decent career. He started off at Arsenal and went on from there. So he had a little bit of pedigree, but I think, as we've said before, it wouldn't matter if Pep, Klopp, Mourinho had the job at this point. It wasn't going to do anything for anyone. So Mr. Rizza was left with an almost impossible task. And he said, well, why not?
So we spoke to Omer and asked him why he wanted to take on the manager's job in those circumstances.
The opportunity had come up. They said, you know what? We've got this many games. I think it was 6, 8. I can't remember what it was. Do you want to do it? And I said, well, look, I'm happy to do the job. I know I can do the job and I'll do my best. Whatever situations that come up, I'll do the best I can do for the club and for the players. And that's what I've done.
Who was that conversation with?
So initially, it was with Vito. Then after I'd spoke with Vito, I then went and met the chairman in his house. Where was it? Mayfair? I can't remember where it was now. Anyway, yeah. Sat down, had a chat with him, Vito and Alessandro, and that was it. You know, it was, yeah, the club maybe being sold. We want to do the best we can do till the end of the season, but there was still, oh, it might be sold, might not be sold. I might stay, I might not, I might stay, might go. It was that sort of conversation. And then I said, yeah, listen, I'll take the position and I'll do the best I can do till the end of the season. And that's what I'd done, because I knew whatever happens at the end of the season, a decision would have to be made on where I'm going to be and what I'm going to be doing, you know.
So you were only offered the role till the end of the season?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they change your contract or you just stayed on?
No. Nothing, no.
What was the atmosphere like when you went to his house? Like, did they feel sort of deflated that it was a sort of end of their era?
No, not at all. It, like I said, there was no definite conversation that he was leaving or that he was staying. It was sort of, this could happen, that could happen. We need to continue to work as normal. And that was really it, you know. And it was, for them, it was sort of, to me, you know, opportunity for you to go and, you know, take the team and, you know, we feel you can do it. And that came more probably from Vito than it did the chairman. Probably Vito told him a little bit about me, and was because he was with me every day, you know, this is what he's like. And sort of that's where it came about. But no, there was no conversations like sort of, it weren't a drab call. It was sort of, go and do your job, do what you need to do. And that's what I'd done. That's what I tried to do.
It feels like end of days, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. One thing I will say about Omar is that throughout all conversation with him, he was always immensely positive and always had this real attitude of, I can do this, I can do this, we're going to make this work. And I think you'll see as we go through the episode and we find more challenges ahead, that attitude is still there, but maybe softened slightly as the reality begins to set in.
Yeah, fair play to him. He was a good guy, wasn't he? He was very positive about everything and probably just thought, why the fuck not? No one else is going to do it.
What else have you got to do on Saturday afternoon for the rest of the season? Why not?
We also spoke to Michael Clark, who was one of the youth team players who was frequently playing in the first team by now, on Omar taking over.
I do think Omar was probably feeling exactly the same as we were. He was just seeing it, the same as us, as his sort of opportunity, whether it had come about on merit or just given the circumstances. It was kind of like, well, we're here now, we might as well make the most of it and get what we can out of it. But yeah, it was just a case of giving it all you can, trying to keep the morale positive, like he joining in training a few times and just making as good as we could out of the situation we were in.
So as if Omar's job wasn't going to be difficult enough as it was, literally the next day after he was appointed, it emerged that staff and players at the club had not been paid their wages for March. What was all that about, James?
Yeah, so you can imagine that Omar's probably spent the previous evening thinking about all the things he's going to say and how he's going to try and galvanise the squad, bring them together. It's us against the world. No one expects us to get out of it. We can do it, lads. Come on. And then he gets to the training ground and he finds out that actually none of those players have been paid, none of the staff being paid. He's not being paid. I really felt for him because how are you supposed to do this almost, an impossible job has just been made even more impossible by the fact that they haven't been paid, and something that you have no control over whatsoever.
My 12-year-old daughter, who has been coming to Orient with me since she was 5, literally a few weeks ago said to me, Daddy, do these players get paid? I was like, what? Of course they get paid. I think, which is probably telling for the quality of football that she was being served up. Anyway, Orient players should be paid. They weren't being paid. Let's listen to how Omar dealt with this situation.
Problem was that the next day when we was going in and I had to address everyone and, you know, make sure that we finish the season strong, they didn't pay anyone. They didn't pay staff, they didn't pay players. That was the next day. So that was difficult. And it was, you know, that was really hard. And I had to pick everyone up from that moment on and try and carry them right till the end of the season.
You found out you weren't getting paid because the money didn't come into your account. But was there any communication from the club explaining why you and the players and the rest of the staff hadn't been paid?
I can't remember clearly, but I think it was, oh, it's going to be, you're going to be paid. And I think there was always like, we was always waiting for the day when we were going to, which was worse, really. You'd rather them just say, oh, we're not paying. But it was like, no, it's going to go in this day, or it's going to go in this day, it's going to go in this day.
So what apparently happened at this point was that Vito Micheli, who was the chief operating officer, Bichetti's right-hand man, called a meeting to explain to the squad and the staff as to why they weren't getting paid. And Michael Clark was at that meeting.
Yeah, so there was talk of it. And then, no, there was something in the press about Bichetti's bank accounts being frozen. So that obviously filtered through to us. And then Vito spoke. It was just a load of waffle, really. I couldn't tell you what he said, but it didn't really add up. And Liam Kelly at the time was the one to sort of pull him on it and say, everything you've just said there is a lie. And at that point, he didn't really have any answers.
So Vito got together the whole squad and explained that you weren't going to be paid.
Yeah, or that it would be delayed, but he didn't know when. There was no sort of time scale on it. The pros obviously sitting there like, well, we've got mortgages and bills to pay. Like, that's not a good enough answer. But that was as far as it got. He didn't have any other answers for us.
Kitman Ada Martin was one of the staff who also didn't receive his wages, and he was also at the meeting with Vito Michelli. Here's his take.
We were brought into the canteen at the ground, at the training ground. So before we went in there, there was me, Liam Kelly, Nicky Hunt. We sat in three different corners of the room because we were going to be the ones that were going to have a go to find out what was going on. Kel spoke really well. Hunty spoke really well. And I kicked it off. Like, what's going on? So it was a load of lies. You knew what was happening and you knew what they were saying wasn't true. You're not going to get paid. But they just swore blind. No, the money will be here today. Don't worry, the money will be here. It's not going to be here today. This went on for about 10 minutes. And because we sat in three corners of the room, this was Vito getting it from every angle. Didn't know where to look. But he's just, as I said, he's covering up. I said, you're getting paid, aren't you? I not get paid. I said, you're getting paid, aren't you? Of course you are. Of course you're getting paid. It's all fruitless what you're saying, but you're getting stuff off your chest. And you just hope that they see sense and pay you.
And here's George Sessions, local journalist at the time, on the same situation.
The wages. We're not getting paid on time. And that was, you know, it was always quite crazy, but that was really sad, actually, because I've got to know a lot of people at the club really well. And all of a sudden, you know, some of them, or a lot of them, had mortgages and, you know, and bills to pay, and they weren't getting paid at all. You know, it's just disgraceful, isn't it, that people are working, doing their jobs for an organisation, for getting into a football club, and they're not being paid. Not just on time, they're not being paid full stop.
I mean, it is absolutely outrageous. It still makes me angry now. So either the catastrophic mismanagement of the club and the finances to reach the point where he can't actually pay anyone, or that he just deliberately did that because at this point he was just so determined to sink the club and to spite everyone that he again just thought, fuck it, I just won't pay anyone, see what happens.
What I do know is that there are a lot of people there who are very badly affected by that financial situation. It's not just affecting the players, is it? It's affecting the backroom staff. It's affecting everyone from the secretaries to the kit man to everyone throughout the club to community liaison. So some of those people would have really struggled to pay their mortgages, feed their families. It's just, there's no excuse for it. Absolutely no excuse for it whatsoever. And just underlined how much trouble the club were in at that stage.
Yeah, it's not as if these were Premier League players who could get in there. Ferrari, Marinello, and zoom off to an expensive nightclub and drown their sorrows. Like, you know, the players themselves don't earn that much. As you say, all of the staff, a lot of them who are doing that because they love Orient and have stuck at the club for years and years and years and probably don't get paid very much. Like, it's disgusting. And note that Bechetti himself didn't have the courage to front that up to anyone and just sent his COO, Vito Michelli, who didn't have any answers, to speak to everyone on his behalf. We spoke to Howard Gould, who we've spoke to in previous episodes. He was a community liaison officer about that.
Vito was now, had become this voice for Bechetti from the top. Through everything went through Vito, through to me, and as I said, I think through to everyone else. Really, it was if you needed to know about your wages or anything, it was through Vito. What's happening, Vito? Don't worry, you know, your wages will be paid. Okay, well, they weren't paid. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Blah blah blah. You couldn't talk to anyone else. He was the only one you could have access to.
So along with all the other things that we've said about Francesco Bechetti, he's also a coward.
He wouldn't front up, would he? He wouldn't go and tell the players himself. He wouldn't tell them we're not getting paid. Own the situation. You're the club president. You're in charge. You call the shots. At this point, he's disappeared and we're not going to see him again. He's taken his ball and he's gone home.
So Omar Rizza, despite all of this, had to get ready for a game the next day. So on the 1st of April, we were due to play Wycombe Wanderers at home. And God knows how he did it. But the first thing we wondered was, in the circumstances, was he actually allowed to pick his own team?
When I was in charge, I didn't have that at all. I had full reign of what I was doing right till the end of the season. Never had him ask me about. The only thing he did ask was, obviously, we had assets like Alzati and players like that at the time. And it was like, you know, if we can get him on the pitch and we can have him playing, it'll help in respect of what his value is. And which I didn't have a problem with, because I was going to play Stephen Alzati anyway. So I suppose in that respect, I suppose that you could class that as a little bit of hand in the works. But no, when I took the team, I chose my system. I chose what players I wanted to play. I chose how I wanted to play and what style I wanted to play. Honestly, that's the case.
Bichetti couldn't even be bothered to pick the team anymore. Lazy. Omar Rizza's debut as Orient manager did not go that well. He got sent off after 45 minutes. Let's listen to what he said about that game.
Yeah, I got sent off that day, yeah. Yeah, I was upset, and I learned a lesson there as well. You know, don't swear at the referee. I was G'd up with everything that had gone on around me. I never had whilst I was trying to calm everyone down and try to make sure everything was smooth and well, I never had no one sort of say to me, oh, just take it, be calm. I didn't have that. And by the time I had it with my staff, it was too late, because I'd already done the damage with the referee and I was sitting up in the stand. So it was a game that, really, we started that game quite well, actually, the Wycombe game. They were just too strong for us, you know. I think that was the case with a lot of the games that we'd lost. It was purely down to experience, which we knew was going to happen.
And here's kit man Ada Martin with his take on that game.
During the first half, one of our coaching staff, who I won't name because I thought he's a nice fella, but he lost it with Barry Richardson, who was the Wycombe goalkeeper coach. And I'm sitting here thinking, what the hell is going on here? Like, I'm the last man standing of the coaching staff now. Been on some really good benches where you have a bit of banter with the away team. But at that time, we're getting relegated. And I walked over to Gareth Ainsworth after about half hour. And I said to him, don't react, mate, please. I said, we're going down. You know we're going down. Just ignore anything that's going on, because it's just inflaming something that doesn't really need inflaming. We lost the game. I walked into the dressing room after half time and I phoned up Eagle. And he goes, all right, what's up? And I cried to him. I went, mate, it's actually gone today. You reach a point where everything goes. And Wycombe at home, everything went for me. Everything. From staff to players, to sending off, to the manager that just got the job. He got sent off and you try and calm him down. I said, it's gone today. I said, we've gone now. That's it, it's done. But that was the real turning point for me. It was done. Wycombe at home, we were a disgrace. Not playing-wise, it was just off the pitch. That weren't the football team that I've grown up with, and it weren't the staff that I've grown up with, and it wasn't the attitude that we had there, you know? It'd gone. Wycombe at home had gone massively.
So, you've been an Orient fan all your life.
Yep.
You know a lot about Orient.
I do.
Who was Omar Rizza's assistant during that first game in charge?
I know the answer, but that's because I looked at the Google Doc before we started recording. But if I hadn't have looked, I wouldn't have remembered. No, and I don't think anyone would remember the answer. So I won't spoil it for the listeners, but you can announce it. Go on.
Well, I mean, this is the crazy situation. I think we'd all just, we were only just keeping up with who the manager was at that point. I'm pretty sure we didn't really know who the assistant was. So when Omar got sent off, got sent up to the stands for the second half, there was some guy standing in the technical area who appeared to be the one instructing the team. I literally had no idea who he was. And I'm pretty sure no one else in the stadium did either. We've subsequently found out who that was. Who was it?
It was Frederico Morey. I'm sure everyone got that at home. Portuguese coach. He just appeared from nowhere. He was there for 45 minutes on the touchline.
I recall he looked about 12, which was quite curious. It can't be very common in football during a home game for pretty much no fan in the stadium to actually know who our own manager was.
Yeah, but I do feel kind of sorry for the bloke as well. I mean,
I was wondering whether the players even knew who he was for that 45 minutes. So we asked Michael Clark that. I don't even remember the guy, but one of the coaches, Federico Moraes, do you remember him?
Vaguely. That name's ringing a bell. I can't think what his role was.
Well, I think he was a youth, he was part just part of the youth coaching setup, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I vaguely remember. Yeah. Wasn't it towards the end of the game that he got sent off?
It was half time.
Bloody hell. Yeah, no, it was we were probably feeling the exact same. Like, what can you do then when you've got a manager? I mean, some of the players may not have known him well,
yeah,
or haven't even spoken to him much.
So what everyone's probably wondering now is if Federico Moraes was Omar Rizzo's assistant and he had to take over as de facto manager for the second half, who was now assisting Federico in this domino effect of Orient coaching staff? The answer is local mechanic Errol McKellar. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, Errol McKellar is an Orient legend, so has been helping out at the club for many years, helps with the youth team set up, runs a local garage in Hackney, is an ambassador for prostate cancer, and does an incredible job for that. So everyone loves Errol. However, we were quite surprised to find that Errol had become assistant manager for 45 minutes. Were you, James?
I mean, we tried everyone else at this point, hadn't we? And it hadn't gone well. But Errol, lovely bloke, great bloke. Why not? What could go wrong?
Yeah, you were next in line after Errol. Lucky he didn't get sent off, or would have been in real trouble.
I would have loved it. I would absolutely loved it, Matt.
Here's what Michael Clark said about Errol.
Yeah. I mean, even from our point of view, Errol used to come to all of our youth team games and he'd be the guy that would give the players sweets before the game, like he'd have pockets full of wine gums and stuff. And now he's in the dugout. Yeah, that was carnage.
He's gone from giving out wine gums to giving out instructions. Fantastic.
As you said, we lost that game 2-0. Despite the efforts of Federico and Errol. Fair play to them. So that was bad. We lost another game. What happened next? Rob Gagliardi exited the club. What happened here, James?
Well, the fans held a minute's silence. I don't think he was particularly missed, but I know that a lot of people felt that he was possibly the most attractive man in football. So on balance, 50-50.
Fair play. He was definitely the most handsome man in football. Right. The 6th of April... the players were told that they were due to pick up their wages, but the wages did not materialise. So the players and staff were still going unpaid. So Orient were due to play Cambridge on the 8th of April, which created some selection headaches for Omar Rizzo. Here he is to explain why.
There was things going on like players didn't want to train, or players were saying they were training and they wasn't, or loads of stuff like that, be prepping sessions, and then someone would say he's not training. Or so I said, you know what, let's just nip it in the bud now. So we took them all in the dressing room. I remember it really vividly, in one of the dressing rooms, sat down, all the seniors, all the younger players, the younger players being Alzetti, Adebayo, Karoma, all those boys. And I said to the seniors, I goes, look, I'm not judging any of you on this situation. I've been in this situation before. I know what it's like. I know how hard it is. But I've been there, and I'm telling you that by not doing it is not the right thing, because I've been through it and I've seen it and I've got punished heavily for it. And I said, you don't want to play, that's fine. Come to me. Come and tell me you're not in the right place. You're mentally not in the right place. And I won't judge you on it. Same with staff. I won't judge you on it. Just let me know so then I can at least make provisions to make sure that everything else is running okay. A lot of them didn't like it. I could feel the negative vibes from it. But I said to them, at the end of the day, these youngsters, they've got opportunities. If you don't want to play, they will play. They're ready to play. Whether they're ready and they're as experienced as you, maybe not. And I said, don't take that opportunity away from these guys. They might never get this opportunity again. And it can lead them to other things. And I proved myself right. And look where they are. I knew I'd done the right thing for the boys, especially because pressure was on them to not play. They was like, well, let's not play this week. And I'm like, you want to boycott it, boycott it. Don't drag these youngsters into it. Give them, let them have the opportunity. And to be fair, the youngsters, they all had to go. They all did well and they've all moved on. Some of them are still there, even youngsters that I've worked with, which is great to see.
Well, it sounds like from what you're saying, for each game, you didn't have the full squad to select from because some players were refusing to play because they weren't being paid, right?
Yeah, and I don't think it was just about being. I think it just got to the point where players were like, you know what, I'm not risking playing, getting injured when there's potentially, I don't know what's going on at the end of the season. I've got potential to go elsewhere. Like, and I get that, you know. And like I said, I didn't judge anyone on it. All I wanted to know was who we had, who was going to be available, and we could do the work.
If you were a League Two standard footballer, I know that's a big stretch of imagination for you, James, because I've seen you take a penalty on the Brisbane Road turf. But just imagine, if you can, you weren't being paid, would you have played?
It's very difficult, isn't it? If I'm not being paid and I've been treated the way I have by the club, by the president and those around him, why am I going to bother? And I have some sympathy with that. But as a fan, you're hoping that the players buy into this more, I suppose, this collectivism about, well, hang on a minute. I know how much this club means to so many people. I know the situation isn't ideal at the moment, but can I bring myself to just raise my level a little bit? I think we do underestimate the negative effect that this had on people's mental health. Yeah, it was a very difficult period mentally for a lot of these players, coming into work, not knowing if they're getting paid, not knowing who was picking the team, not knowing what was going to happen with the club, if there was even going to be a club. And I think all that weighed on their minds, and that's a very difficult place to be. And I think we have to have some degree of empathy or sympathy for the players.
I don't blame them in any way. It's their job. If you're not being paid, they shouldn't have to work.
Well, you know, I've always said that someone who writes for a living, if you want me to write for you, you have to pay. I'm not going to do it for free. Why should I?
I have told you that you're not getting paid for this podcast, haven't I?
That's not what you said at the start.
Awkward. So for the game against Cambridge, there were only three senior players in the team. So Michael Clark was, as we know, one of the youth team players who was being selected and played that Cambridge game. Here's his take on what the situation looked like at that point.
There was more chance was playing with the first team almost refusing to play. It was kind of like, well, why should I play and sort of risk injury to mess me up for next season for a club that's not giving me anything back, you know? I think we kind of knew at the time that it wasn't earned. Like, I think the majority of us played 10 games. And those 10 games, or at least the last five, we knew probably weren't on merit, but it was just a case of showcasing yourself because it is a platform for us at the end of the day.
So we lost 3-0 to Cambridge, despite the efforts of the youth team. We were now bottom of the table, 10 points from safety with 5 games to go. A few days later, on the 13th of April, the wages were promised again, but have still not materialised. And what that meant was it was now becoming really hard to actually get the Orient games on because, as we've said, it wasn't just the players not being paid, but the staff. Here's Omar Rizza again to explain why.
People weren't, they hadn't been paid, so they weren't going to come to work. So I would give someone some money to be able to get in or whatever it was out of my own pocket, which I weren't being paid either, you know, but it was what it was. And then there was like, I don't know, a staff member who would be, it might have been a doctor, or it might have been a physio or who hadn't been paid. And then they would, just before kickoff, say not coming in or like, at stuff like that, when it's just like, well, hold on, you knew that if that was the case, you could have let me know that so that I don't have this problem. So I'd have to have a physio that I knew that I would have on standby, say, I need you in here if this happens. Because if I was looking at it like, if the games don't go ahead, whether this guy is done right or wrong, the club's going to pay for it. The club's going to pay for it. The players are going to pay for it. And it's not professional. And that's all I ever see is that what is professional and what isn't. What's professional behaviour and what isn't professional behaviour? And I've always acted in a professional way, in a professional manner. And that weren't going to change. So, players not being paid and then wanting to sort of take equipment out of the at a gym, or you know, take an ultrasound machine as collateral for if they don't get stuff like that. It was really crazy. It was a real tough time, and I don't judge anyone on it. You know, I remember having to have a meeting with all the players, senior and youth, who was around the first team, and I told them, you know, that was a hard conversation, you know, but I had to do it. You know, they might have looked at me like, who's this guy all of a sudden coming in? And but I had to do it. I had to be honest. I had to be hard talking, and I needed to let them know. Listen, everyone should get paid. There's no excuse. There's no excuse. It was all wrong. There's nothing that he done that was right.
That is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? It's got to a point where they've just taken it into their own hands because nobody is listening. There's no money in sight. They're not getting any kind of communication. It must have been such a desperate and horrible place to be by this point.
Things were so desperate. I mean, how much do you think you can get for an ultrasound machine on the black market?
All right, it depends on the model, actually. You'd be surprised, but you can get a decent whack, I reckon, yeah.
I knew you'd know the answer to that. So there was a genuine risk that upcoming fixtures weren't going to go ahead. And this was something that the EFL was actually worried about. So, for example, a game can't be played if there aren't any St. John's ambulance staff present and they need to be paid. So the EFL, which, as we know, boasts some of the most brilliant minds in the country, came up with the idea that the Leighton Orient Fans Trust could step in here. Here's Loft Vice Chair Tom Davies to explain.
When it hadn't contacted us directly, they suggested to a club, apparently, that this is something that Loft could do. Because obviously, they're like, oh, well, maybe these good-hearted supporters will just, you know, rally around their team and pay the ambulance men. So that was kind of, yeah, and obviously it was scoffed at and, you know, got quite a furious, jokey, you know, you're taking the piss, aren't you, type response. Nothing more was heard of it, but it was symptomatic of the chaos of the club and the chaotic response to it from the football authorities.
Let me get this right, Matt. It was suggested that the Leighton Orient Fans Trust pay for the St. John's ambulance to be present at the game so the game could take place.
That is correct. And we also talked to kitman Ada Martin about the difficulty of getting the games on during that period.
We had free credit cards, and my one was the last one to be used up because I just weren't paying them off.
Yeah.
So you could get credit, but once that all ran out, that was it. We were buying stuff for match days out of our own pockets, really, like player supplements and that. I was going shopping with the missus at Tesco's and buying some energy gels, things like that, just to use at the next game, just in case.
Thanks to the efforts of Ada and the rest of the staff, the next two games did go ahead, and actually Orient did pretty well. We drew 2-2 at Luton, then beat Hartlepool at home 2-1. So that gave fans a glimmer of hope that maybe the club could avoid relegation, although we were still 7 points from safety with 3 games to go. Here's Omar Rizza on those two games.
Yeah, they're the ones that stick out the most, really, obviously, because of the performances and the way the boys played. For me, I just felt at least we're giving something back to the crowd. For those moments, they were happy, you know. All that animosity and all that sort of that ill feeling and stuff like that. For those brief moments, Luton, Hartlepool, we gave them something. So I look at it like we gave the fans something back, which was important because it was all negative. There were the positives, and then the players got what they needed to kick on in their careers. And the club didn't get fined, and the club didn't pick up any silly fines for not playing and this, that or the other. And I left it in as best a position as I could.
So while this was all going on, staff and players still weren't being paid.
I mean, it got really bad. I think, I don't know if you remember Neil Barron. Neil was a sports massage therapist. And 2 days after the Hartlepool game, the Orient staff released a statement pertaining to the non-payment of wages. On that same day, Neil tweeted that he'd actually left his job. Well, he didn't leave. So this is what he said. I asked for travel expenses so I could at least get in to help. It was rejected, so they're getting someone else in to do my job. #end of 7 years. So that's a guy who worked for Orient for 7 years, couldn't afford to get to work because he hadn't been paid, asked for expenses, and was told to get walking. Some of the treatment of staff at that point is just something completely rotten through the whole club. Just horrendous. Just horrendous, Matt.
Fans actually set up, if you remember, a separate appeal to help pay the staff directly. So fans were actually literally paying the wages of staff and players out of their own pockets at this point. Here's Howard Gould on that.
Well, when, you know, I'll never forget when the supporters rallied around and actually there was donations came in and there was this amount of money that was paid into the club, which was divided amongst the staff. And they did that properly. They did it, you know, full time, got more money. And like, if there was a little somebody, you know, everyone got something. Even if you were part time, you did an hour a day and you went in, you got like 10 quid. You know, like, this is from the supporters. There's a tenner. It worked like that, right from the bottom all the way to the top. And it was, I found it quite emotional, you know, the just general public knew the situation and felt so strongly about what this guy was doing that they needed to help us. And I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that.
I mean, I felt the same in all of the terrible things that were going on. Actually, one of the things that gave us hope was just the way fans united together to try and support the club and the players and the staff. So, yeah, I thought that was a really important moment and a moment that just made you remember why you support Leyton Orient and why the club was so important to us.
Yeah, I think it was incredible to see the amount of love being shown towards the club, towards the employees. But it wasn't just Orient fans. I remember we had people going to collect outside other football clubs. I think they went to Spurs and collected there, West Ham, Arsenal. There were football fans from across London who were donating money at this point. Even though it was a very dark time for a football club, the way the fans came together, I thought, was very, very inspiring. You can see, you can hear in Howard's voice just how emotional he was getting talking about that. I think it says something about how special our club is.
Yeah, at the same time, listeners will recall that we still have a court case coming up on the 12th of June where Orient were facing a winding up order. And as we spoke about in the last episode, Leyton Orient Fans Trust were mobilising to do what they can to try and help in that situation. And one of the things they were doing was creating a disaster recovery fund. So let's hear from Tom Davis, Vice Chair of Loft again, on how that was going.
The Disaster Recovery Fund took off and you got quite a lot of money from that pretty quickly. Do you remember the amounts?
It was about 170,000. Most of it was still in an account reserved for a rainy day. Actually, it's really good. When we played teams who've been in similar crisis, their own fans absolutely were game changers. So we played Lewin on Good Friday, who'd obviously a few years earlier had all sorts of problems themselves, and they really helped out a lot. And so we had some good support from the Spurs Supporters Trust, actually. They did a collection at their game on Easter Saturday that year. So suddenly it was, we were getting a lot of publicity at that point. I was on the day program and things like that. So it was a big news story.
But importantly, Loft weren't using that fund to pay players and staff wages. Tom explains why.
One of the things we were quite adamant about, and that was part of the actual remit of what we voted on having and setting up a regeneration fund, was we weren't going to give money directly to the club while Bocchetti was there, because you couldn't trust him within it. It would just be wasted, you know, be throwing your money away.
So basically, Orient fans were donating both to the regeneration fund and to the separate fund to help play staff and players. So again, it really was the community coming together. Back on the pitch, we were due to play Crewe away on the 22nd of April and had to win that game to stand even the slightest chance of avoiding relegation. Unfortunately, the game ended in a 3-0 defeat, which meant that Orient lost their status as a Football League club for the first time in their history.
Felt like something had died that day. And in a way, I was just... I suppose in a perverse way, I was just glad it was over. That's it. Right. Done. We're down. There was no more prolonging the agony. There was no more glimmer of hope to be followed by more disappointment. It was meek. It was limp. It was just a really sad day. And I think what made it worse was that we didn't know if we'd still have an Orient next season. Getting relegated as a football fan is part of life, especially as a Leighton Orient supporter. But Orient always being there was not anything, you know, I never ever thought that Orient wouldn't be there until that season. And suddenly you're in a position where something that you love so much and has been such an integral part of your life, your daily life, we really think about and talk about, if you ask my wife, is in jeopardy. I just felt as if the bad guy had won. You know, he'd said, right, fine, you don't like me. I'm going to take the thing that's most precious to you. And at that point, it felt like he kind of had. I was just very, very down.
I felt absolutely devastated by this because Orient, pretty much since the early 80s, have been a club that are in either League One or League Two. I got no issue with watching lower league football. It wasn't the fact that we were going to be in the National League because of the quality of the football, because frankly, the quality of the football at Leighton Orient tends to be absolutely shit. But just the principle that we were 3 years ago, potentially a penalty kick away from being promoted to the Championship, and then suddenly we're in the National League, just felt so devastating. And with everything else that was going on, the risk to the existence of the club itself, I was absolutely devastated. Let's listen to Omar Reza's take on the relegation at Crewe.
We were always holding on, you know. If I'm being honest, just the way I am, I was like, we're going to win and we're going to try and survive. That was me from the minute I got it to the end, the last game, when it was mathematically impossible, I was like, you know what, if we draw this or win this, we might just be able to, because that's just the way I think. So yeah, it was a sad day, but it was one that was expected and that was coming. You know, I knew we were just too young, too inexperienced, not physical enough, all those things we knew, and it was just only a matter of time. I knew it was coming, and I knew that me taking the position at the end of it, I'll have relegation on my CV, but it wasn't for me. The relegation on my CV just shows like who I am, in respect of sometimes people need those relegations in order to kick on in their careers, you know. Yeah. And whether I was involved with it from the start or not, I was involved with it at the end, and I'll take that all day long.
We asked Michael Clarke what the atmosphere was like in the dressing room after relegation was confirmed.
Just quiet afterwards. I think, to be fair, I think we all knew that it was coming. But yeah, there wasn't much that anyone said, because it had been coming for a good few weeks at least. Yeah, that was kind of the final nail in the coffin, and that was it confirmed. But from sort of the point of view of us young players, it was nothing. There's nothing to lose now in terms of us playing and us having our opportunity.
And so, even by our own tradition of ending each episode on the lowest point possible, that is a particularly bad ending. But there's more to come, because there are still two games to go. Staff and players still aren't being paid, and there's a small matter of a winding up order hanging over the club's head. And in the next episode, the fans fight back. And there's a very special goal by a very special player. Are you excited about that, James?
Cannot wait. Cannot wait.
Good. Well, that is it. Thanks everyone for listening, and we will see you for episode 13.
Arrivederci.
Oh, that was a good one.
I've been practicing.
That one. That was an expansive wave and quite a flourish on your accent there.
My next door neighbour's Italian, and he's been giving me lessons.
Nice.